The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Bjorkman, Judge Bratfold, Judge Harris, the Honorable Louise Dudley Bjorkman presiding.
Good morning. Please be seated. And welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It is Thursday, April 24th. We have three matters on the calendar for oral argument this morning. The first being State of Minnesota versus Amon Linton Dixon, Jr. Counsel, I'll just remind you of our rules. You will each have 15 minutes to present your argument, and counsel for appellant, you will also have 5 minutes for rebuttal. It's important that you state your name and identify the party you represent when you begin your arguments, because we are making an audio recording, and that is the only recording that is permitted. Finally, the podium can be raised and lowered. There's a button in the middle to meet your needs. So with that, counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honors, Counsel, may it please the Court. My name is Sarah Koziel, and I am attorney for Appellant Amon Dixon. This Court must reverse the District Court's order denying appellant's motion to suppress because the four corners of this warrant lacked probable cause. This warrant, which relies on just two scant paragraphs of bare factual assertions to support probable cause, fails. The District Court should have suppressed, and this Court must reverse. At the outset, this warrant contains only bare assertions and conclusory statements, which fails as a matter of law under State versus Gabbert, and even under State versus Campbell, a case that the state provided just this week to supplement its argument. A bare bones assertion does not support probable cause without showing the math underlying the equation, and that is what is essentially missing from this entire affidavit.
So if there had been a sentence in the application that said, that after this first, the warrant was signed and the package was opened and there was 20,000 fentanyl pills in it. If that sentence had been in this application, would that have been enough?
Not necessarily, because the basis for the conclusion still needs to link the conclusion to an individual person, which is what is missing here. So no, I don't think it would have been enough to say the package was opened. We need to know who opened the package and what the basis for the conclusion is. But even reading the two warrants the state urges should be read together, they still don't even say that minimal sentence. What is missing here is any support underlying the conclusions that the officer said could indicate that drugs were present at the home. The affidavit doesn't even say that drugs would be found. It says, based on the foregoing information, drugs could be at this Xerxes Avenue address, and that is not enough. It's implicit.
Counsel, if you don't mind, and Judge Bjorkman doesn't mind, I'd like to follow up. You said that it wouldn't be enough if the affidavit had added that the package was opened and 20,000 fentanyl pills were inside, because we wouldn't know who opened it. So how specific does that need to be, counsel? Not enough that it's another law enforcement agency?
I don't think it needs to be overly specific, and it's clear from the case law that that's not required. But on the record,
but you think it's required that in by case law that it's who opened the package?
Not necessarily. So recent.
Okay.
Not necessarily, but our contention is that just saying that the package was open still wouldn't cure multiple defects in this warrant, not only on the four corners, but the nexus to the address. Now,
I understand your nexus argument is separate, but I want to go back. Probable cause, okay.
But on the record before us, Your Honor, there is not a sentence which could even arguably cure the four corners defect, because we don't have anything in that affidavit. So
you mean we don't have anything in the affidavit? We do. I mean, clearly the affidavit includes some facts.
Sure. So right. The three main facts in the affidavit, beginning with just to highlight what's missing here. Beginning with, your affiant received information that the package contained approximately 20,000 fentanyl pills. I submit this is a bare assertion, because what's missing? Well, the source for this assertion is missing. There's a footnote in respondent's brief which indicates that Well, the source was law enforcement, but that's not in the four corners.
Well, it says after the parcel alert, the parcel was seized and brought to the Airport Police Criminal Investigations Office. Isn't that rational inference, or the reasonable inference from that is that it's somebody from the Airport Police Criminal Investigations Office was the one that opened the package?
I don't think that is the only rational inference. Another rational inference that's available on these scant facts is that a dog whose credentials are unknown, whose training is unknown, which case law is clear, requires some acknowledgement of a dog's credentials in order to support probable cause, could have alerted at the package. The package could have been weighed, could have put through an X-ray machine. It's possible based on, and not excluded based on the language in this affidavit, that no one opened the package. And for Judge Lamas to specifically conclude that an investigatory step happened, which is absent from the affidavit, was an error. And that is why this court should reverse. And even though the affidavit...
We do apply a totality analysis, though, don't we, counsel, to this? We don't isolate out sentence by sentence the affidavit, the facts in the affidavit, do we?
In the four corners of a single affidavit?
Right, single affidavit, yes.
Yes, but the approach advanced...
Because that's what I hear your statement doing. I mean, it sounds to me as though you're focused on the one sentence that say it doesn't explain enough, the parcel was seized and brought to the airport police, but we have quite a few other sentences. So, for instance, at the beginning of the affidavit's portion going into the package, it says your affiant received information from Officer Irvin of the airport police. And it does go on to say specific about this controlled delivery, but then the affiant goes on to say it received information that the package contained. You know, it may be a reasonable inference that all of the information came from either Officer Irvin or from the airport police. I mean, given the whole context of all of this set of sentences.
And even so, even accepting that that is a reasonable inference, that is still not enough.
Because
the only other sentence, the only investigatory step that is addressed in this affidavit is, quote, a dog sniff was conducted and the dog gave a positive alert for the odor of narcotics. But what is an alert? What distinguishes an alert from other regular dog behavior?
I'm not sure why that matters in this case, given there's also the assertion that the package does, that the officer received information that the package does include 20,000 pills of fentanyl. So why does it matter that about the dog alert? That obviously was important for the prior warrant that's also referred to, but I'm not seeing it here.
A dog's training and credentials are essential
for that
probable
prior
cause.
Warrant, for sure.
For probable cause.
But why for this warrant?
Because the record does not reflect that when signing this warrant, the judge who is responsible for assessing whether probable cause existed on the face of that warrant actually had probable cause. And it is unreasonable for a respondent to ask district courts who might be serving signing duty in a busy jurisdiction, signing dozens, if not more, warrants per day, to have to recall and pierce through what a law enforcement officer is providing, recall previous warrants, when there's no indication that on the face of that warrant that a judge subjectively linked those two things.
I guess I'm struggling, as Judge mm-hmm. Bratfeld suggested, with what difference that makes. It seems to me I'm looking at the paragraph that talks about the warrant as sort of explaining how the affiant understands there are 20,000 fentanyl pills in this package, rather than whether that prior warrant was valid or not.
That's the problem, is it doesn't explain how the affiant knew that there were 20,000 fentanyl
pills. To me, as I reasonably read it, and I think the district court did as well, the fact that there was this previous warrant because of the dog alert would explain how we come to know what is inside of that package, and that is that the search warrant was of this package, and it was opened, and the 20,000 fentanyl pills were found.
But that wasn't even the facts that existed in the world. The previous warrant was to conduct a dog sniff in the first place. The facts in the world are not the same as the inquiry before the district court.
So why do you assume that, counsel, that the prior warrant was to actually have the dog sniff conducted?
We know that from the affidavit of the 9:30 a.m. warrant. The there is no warrant.
Ask me not to look at that, counsel. So I'm just confused by your argument.
It's in the record. It's in the record. And it is not properly part of the analysis of whether the 328 warrant is proper. That's our argument. But even if we are assuming for purposes of argument momentarily that the other warrant should be considered, first, we don't have any evidence that it actually was. Both of the cases that the state provides to support its argument, both the Maizzo case and the Campbell case, involve an extended record at the district court about what that magistrate knew. And it only pierced through what the objective, it only pierced through the objective four corners test after the affidavit failed the four corners test. And then district courts can look to what did the magistrate subjectively know. We do not have a record of that here. We only have a four corners warrant, which fails, and the additional facts that respondent relies on in its brief show the weakness, and I would argue the concession that this warrant on its face does not have probable cause. Having to rely on extraneous facts only is allowed under Minnesota case law, where there is an incorporation into the four corners, either by testimony after the fact by the officer, which twice appellate and Supreme Courts in Minnesota have strongly cautioned district courts against doing. Or judges can write on the four corners of the warrant. An easy fix would have been available for law enforcement here. Law enforcement could have submitted multiple warrants at the same time in the second request for a warrant. It is asking too much of district court judges to have to remember and recall and pierce through what law enforcement is telling a district court that they must remember all of the facts that they encountered earlier that day.
Right, it's supposed to be just sort of a reasonable, practical decision, right?
Yes, exactly. And on the four corners of this warrant, it was not reasonable to conclude that certain investigatory steps happened when they didn't. That is akin to assuming credibility where there's no information that credibility exists. And just like we don't assume that police officers are acting maliciously or making mistakes, we can't presume that investigation is happening when it's never explained.
So, counsel, if you don't mind, one more time, explain to me why it's not a reasonable inference that the package was opened by the airport police. And I apologize if it seems like I'm asking you that twice, but if you don't mind.
It's not reasonable because the four corners of the warrant don't
say
that.
I hear you say it's an assumption, and I'm just trying to understand what's the difference between an assumption
and a reasonable. And respondent is absolutely correct that reasonable inferences are available to district courts. That's absolutely right. It's not reasonable to infer one specific investigatory course when multiple were available based on the facts provided. The assertions provided do not rule out other ways to.
So you described some of those other inferences you thought were reasonable, but I didn't understand them to include counting 20,000 fentanyl pills. I mean, there seemed to be only one way to do that, and that's open the package and and count them. And given it's airport police involved, the package was seized and brought to the police. It just seems like there's this series of events that clearly imply something.
I'm sorry to keep cutting off, but the approximately 20,000 fentanyl pills in the affidavit, which we submit as a conclusory statement, there are other ways to arrive at that. The dog could have been trained specifically to alert at fentanyl. The package could have been weighed and an estimate created. I would argue that would significantly weaken probable cause to even open the package. There are multiple other ways that this investigation could have failed based on the language of this affidavit. Hearsay within the multiple police officers that are coordinating this investigation. Misunderstandings. The involvement of a tipster. This affidavit doesn't rule any of those things out, and it is an error to assume that something was done above board perfectly correctly when we don't have the math underlying the equation.
Counsel, what I hear your argument as is that because the facts support other inferences, this reasonable inference that the fentanyl pills were discovered based on that investigation, it's not reasonable because there are other inferences. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yes, but not just other inferences, other reasonable inferences.
So do you have to exclude all other reasonable inferences for a district court judge to rely on this reasonable inference? So if there are multiple reasonable inferences, can a district court judge utilize the one reasonable inference that is reasonable. So, for example, could Judge Lamas, could there be a reasonable inference that the fentanyl pills were discovered by some other investigatorial process, but Judge Lamas just chose to use this reasonable inference?
Certainly not. Probable cause, as this panel is well aware, is a strong and honest suspicion that contraband is present. So certainly a warrant affidavit need not exclude any other realm of possibility. But on this record, it is so scant that not only does it fail to exclude other reasonable hypotheses consistent with no contraband being present, it does not show that law enforcement did what was necessary to go through the substantial privacy invasion of discovering suspected contraband at the airport and embarking on a full rummaging search of a private home at a third location. That is the issue here, is we're dealing with such an intense privacy interest that requires, at a minimum, a neutral magistrate making sure that the police did their job correctly. And that did not happen here, and that is the error that this court should correct. And I have 20 seconds left, and I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Okay, thank you. Counsel for respondent.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court and opposing counsel. My name is Robert Yount, Assistant Hennepin County Attorney, and I represent the state of Minnesota in today's matter. Now, there are two issues before the court today. The first is whether the four corners of Officer Spee's affidavit on its own supported Magistrate Piper's issuance of the search warrant to search the house. The state believes that it did. But if this court disagrees, then the state believes that this court should then consider the eight corners of the two affidavits that were submitted before the same magistrate contemporaneously to each other in the course of the same investigation on February 15th, 2024, because construing both of those together provides more than ample support for a substantial basis for Magistrate Piper to issue that subsequent search warrant. The state believes that that fully accords with the Fourth Amendment, as well as existing Minnesota case law dating back to the 60s.
Did you make that argument?
Yes.
In the district court.
I'd like to address that head on, Your Honor, because I think it's a good point. I would say that we aren't even in the Gruning or Polar era because the state squarely raised that argument and then they received an adverse ruling on it. So in the memorandum opposing the motion to suppress, the state attached to it that copy of that MAP affidavit submitted in support of the search warrant. So the state was essentially asking the court to consider it. In that footnote 2 of the district court order denying the motion to suppress, it then specifically denied that request and said it's only limiting its analysis to Officer Spee's affidavit. The state takes the position that that fully preserved the issue for appellate review. And I'll note, to the extent that the appellant here could argue any sort of ambushing or prejudice, the record dispels that as well, because an appellant's principal brief on subparagraph 5 of the procedural history, appellant himself in his brief notes that this was something that was raised below and that the district court rejected it. So the state's position is that that issue has been squarely preserved if this court disagrees with the four corners of Officer Spee's affidavit. I'd like
counsel, just to clarify your comment about having preserved the error below, you say you attached the second search warrant to the memorandum in opposition to the motion to suppress. Was there an argument made about how the district court should consider how, why, what legal basis the district court should consider that second or prior search warrant?
I'd say the memorandum is quite, it's a full-throated defense about all of the steps that law enforcement took on that singular day on February 15th, 2024. I would say that the state was basically checking through each of the steps that both the MAP and the MPD took that day. The state was viewing it as a whole. I would say that that preserves the issue on appeal about whether this court can construe both of those affidavits.
I have to be very specific with you. So did the memorandum, state's memorandum below, mention any of the case law
No.
that you've submitted to our court and you've acknowledged has never been adopted or recognized in the state of Minnesota or by the Supreme Court?
Correct, Your Honor. The state agrees
right.
that those cases
okay.
were not cited. The contemporaneous language for those other doctrines accepted throughout the nation was not cited below. The state agrees with that. The record clearly states that. And that is why the state also believes that if this court were to disagree that that issue wasn't sufficiently preserved, then still under Gruning, it would still be available. Because the record was established below, which is the first prong of the Gruning analysis, and it would not expand the scope of relief that the state is asking this court on appeal, which would be, again, affirming that search warrant for the house.
So going back to probable cause under the four corners of the search warrant that did, that is the heart of this case. So why is it that the district court is able to make this assumption about the package being open and counted by
sure.
the airport police?
Yep. No, that's a good question, Your Honor. And so I think the language that my friend across the aisle used was, you know, the math underlying the equation. I think that Officer Spee's affidavit sufficiently sets forth what that math was. So Officer Spee communicated to Magistrate Piper that he had received information from Officer Irving with the MAP, and then he proceeded to recite the information that he received from the MAP and Officer Irvin. That included that there was a parcel that had been previously intercepted, that there was a positive dog sniff on the parcel, that they had, quote unquote, obtained a warrant to search the parcel. That use of that verb, obtained a warrant, means that a warrant was obtained as a result of the dog sniff. And I also want to clarify something in the record. I think the appellant suggested that the first MAP affidavit was submitted in order to perform a dog sniff. That's incorrect. The dog sniff was performed on the parcel, and then they used the result of that dog sniff, the positive alert for the narcotics present in the parcel, in order to substantiate its search warrant. Which is all to say that that is the math underlying the equation, and the only reasonable inference is that the MAP, or officers with the MAP, opened up that parcel. And to Judge Bradfield's point, the only way they would know there's 20,000 pills in there.
That's not my point, counsel. That's the question. So the only way they would know. I mean, is that really the standard that we have to reach today, that
no.
this was the only inference that could be drawn from these facts?
Absolutely not. And I think I'd like to pivot and answer Judge Harris's question about, you know, does the state bear an obligation to disprove other reasonable inferences or anything like that? That's not the standard. Rather, the standard is whether there is a substantial basis on the evidence that would have led the magistrate to conclude that there was probable cause. And again, the language of the courts of appellate practice use is that it's afforded great deference. And so if there is a reasonable inference that could lead Magistrate Piper to conclude that the reason they found and counted 20,000 pills was as a result of opening that parcel, that again was in the custody of the MAP, that's the reasonable inference that should sustain and stand on appeal. The fact that that reasonable inference exists, and I would suggest is the only reasonable inference, I agree the state does not bear an obligation to disprove other inferences, but in this record it's very clear. The MAP seized the parcel. The MAP got a search warrant for the parcel. The MAP searched the parcel, and then they coordinated with the MPD to do a controlled delivery of that parcel with the 20,000 pills. I'd like to turn now to briefly talk about additional factors in Officer Spee's affidavit that supports the totality of the circumstances, because I don't think that the way appellate characterizes it is truly fair to all of the reasonable inferences and the facts that are in that affidavit. So, for example, we also know that that parcel that was going to the Xerxes Ave address was being sent by expedited delivery. That's not a common snail mail delivery. It was expedited to be delivered before 7 p.m. that day. There's a sense of urgency with that parcel going to that address. Second of all, and perhaps of utmost importance in this case, is we have to remember that this was an anticipatory search warrant. And what that means is that there was a triggering event that would have happened, had to happen, before the officers executed that search warrant. And that triggering event was not only the controlled delivery of the parcel to that Xerxes Ave residence, but was an individual at that residence receiving it and bringing it inside. And the reason why that's critical in this case is because when the moment that the officers executed that search warrant took place, they had actual knowledge that now there's a wholesale amount of drugs that are within that residence. That had been mailed there on an expedited basis that morning from Arizona. So the anticipatory search warrant nature of this also further increases the totality of circumstances. You have a wholesale amount of drugs that are found that they have actual knowledge, not even just a CI, not even a CRI, not even circumstantial evidence like, you know, perhaps a garbage pull. They have actual knowledge that there's 20,000 pills of fentanyl in that house.
But in terms of the nexus, I mean, I have to say, it strikes me that compared to many other cases that I've been involved with or read in my, I mean, it seems kind of skinny here. There's no effort to say who this Alexis Dixon is, no effort to say that there's any significance about the package coming from Arizona or even explaining why the expedited delivery is significant. How do you respond to that?
And I agree, Your Honor. This is not the strongest search warrant that I've ever seen, that the state has ever seen. The state's certainly not holding it out to be that. The question, though, is what does the Constitution mandate? Again, it doesn't require perfection. It doesn't require a robust, 10-page affidavit. It just doesn't require that. So we're here really on a question about, does this meet the standard for what the Constitution requires? And I would direct this court's attention back to the State v. Brosh decision, which was actually cited in an appellant's briefing, because I think that that offers a two-dimensional example of what this three-dimensional case really represents. So in State v. Brosh, which is a 1982 decision, there was a parcel that was intercepted on its way to a P.O. box, and it listed the defendant's name. They coordinated with a confidential informant to find out where the defendant resided. They then did a controlled delivery to the P.O. box. They observed the defendant pick it up and bring it to her house. The Minnesota Supreme Court held that that alone was sufficient. Now compare that to what we have here. In that case, there was about 14 grams of hashish, I believe it was. That was about a singular usage amount of drugs. Here we have 20,000 fentanyl pills going to a house. And that's really where the State v. Yarborough and the Novak v. State cases kick in, is they recognize that when you have a drug wholesaler amount at issue and you're talking about probable cause to search a residence, that is a weighty consideration favoring execution of that search warrant.
And usually you'd see in an affidavit exactly that. You'd say, in addition to the affiant having all this experience, you would say, this amount suggests that, we don't have any of that in this affidavit.
And I agree, Your Honor, that information is missing from the affidavit. And again, it's the state's position that Officer Spee's affidavit, for all the reasons listed, is sufficient, given the State v. Brosh decision, all the other ones cited, and given the fact that this is a wholesale amount of drugs, 20,000 fentanyl pills. But turning to that second issue is, if the court disagrees, the state really does believe that this represents a vehicle of a case that upon which this court could really adopt that contemporaneous warrant doctrine. And just to be clear, what that syllabus point would look like is that when there are multiple affidavits that are submitted contemporaneously in the same investigation to the same magistrate, that those affidavits can be read together for purposes of a probable cause challenge. And that really boils down to, what are we asking on a probable cause challenge to a search warrant? We're asking what the magistrate knew at that point in time. Now, the language that courts have used to describe that in the past has been, we look to the four corners of the affidavit. I would submit to the court that, conceptually speaking, there's kind of two strands of cases talking about viewing affidavits. There's those in which there's just an affidavit that is submitted to the court, period. And again, the state maintains that in those situations where all that is before that magistrate, the only thing that we can consider on a probable cause challenge is the four corners of the affidavit. That case law, that language talking about the four corners, really developed to prevent consideration of what the police could have possibly known outside of the affidavit. You see cases back in the 80s and 90s where the state argued, well, yeah, but the cops knew way more than what was in the affidavit. And the court said, that doesn't matter because the magistrate didn't know it. That's the importance of that four corners language. But compare it to what we have here, which is the State v. Campbell, the State v. Mizo, and again, which has been recognized in State v. Ault as being still good law, is you have an affidavit plus. You have that affidavit.
Do we have an affidavit plus? We do in the record.
Yes.
But the magistrate at the time that we have one affidavit in front of us for decision today,
yes,
right? And at the time that the district court judge, actually, Judge Piper, signed it, mm-hmm, he had just this affidavit, right? I mean, he didn't have the one that he had signed several hours earlier in that affidavit. There's no reference made to it. I mean, why would we make that leap? Especially where we have no guidance from the Supreme Court. As best I know, the Supreme Court hasn't even considered this issue.
And I agree, Your Honor. The record reflects just as you described it. Officer Spee did not submit that prior search warrant application or the affidavit attached to his application made at 3:30 p.m. that day. But I think that this case illustrates a great example of why that should not be or is not constitutionally required. It's entirely possible, based on this record, that Officer Spee had not yet seen that underlying application. Remember, things are going very fluid. They're going very fast. We have a delivery of a parcel that's going to be they're trying to do a controlled delivery at or before 7 p.m. that day. Officer Spee is working with MAP officers. MAP officers, including Officer Irvin, are communicating information to him about trying to coordinate that coordinated delivery. And so to respond in a pointed way is that it's entirely possible that Officer Spee did not have that underlying application in his possession. And so what he did was he was communicating the information he had. But what this doctrine recognizes is that over the course of those 4 to 5 hours, Magistrate Piper, and I use that just in the common Fourth Amendment parlance. He is a district court judge, as you mentioned. I just want to distinguish Magistrate Piper from District Court Lamas. But Magistrate Piper had that information inside of his head because he had previously signed the search warrant for that parcel. And again, that's the requirement with that doctrine about it being contemporaneous.
Searching a parcel at an airport mail area versus searching someone's home? It seems like that makes a difference, doesn't it?
Absolutely, Your Honor. I do think that the home is where your privacy is the strongest. The case law commonly recognizes that, I should say. But again, the search warrant for the house here followed that initial search, followed that initial dog sniff, followed that initial opening of the parcel and finding a wholesale amount of drugs. I'd like to briefly just address the importance of this canine training issue because it was raised with my friend across the aisle's opening remarks. The canine training would really only have relevance if she was challenging that first search warrant about the probable cause to issue that search warrant, appellant is not challenging that first search warrant. And really the importance of the canine training or the dog sniff is what it found and led to, which was the 20,000 fentanyl pills. So for purposes of this case, challenging that subsequent search warrant of the house, the canine training and the canine sniff really aren't really relevant to the analysis. The state believes that Officer Spee's affidavit on its own was sufficient to support the search warrant of the house, and the state further believes that if this court disagrees, it should consider the eight corners of the two affidavits that were submitted contemporaneously to the same magistrate in the same investigation to find that there was sufficient substantial basis for Magistrate Piper to issue that search warrant. Unless the court has any further questions.
Thank you. Ms. Koziel, you will have the last word.
The state is arguing for a new law to advance its position in this particular case, which is a sign of the weakness of the four corners here. The fact that respondent claims that the canine sniff doesn't even matter for this affidavit at issue here shows the problem. That is the only investigatory step that is explained, and that is why this warrant fails. It is clear based on the state's motion below in opposition to appellant's motion to suppress that the state did not squarely raise a request to change the law. And even if we are going to entertain that for a moment, let's not forget that these warrants are not contemporaneous. There is a warrant at 9:30 in the morning for a package at the airport, ostensibly for a magistrate who is signing warrants all day long in the busiest jurisdiction in Minnesota. And respondent would have that district court responsible for every single thing that they signed throughout the day, every single time they picked up a new warrant. That is unreasonable to put on district court judges, and frankly, the police's job. And that shift of burden, that shift of responsibility between the executive and the judicial branch is precisely what the concurrence in Campbell and the final sentence in Mizo warn against. This is not the desired practice. District courts need what they need in the four corners in front of them when they are making these types of common sense decisions. Now, I also think that it's important to note that the discussion of MAP getting a warrant, MAP searching the package, MAP coordinating with the police, expedited delivery from Arizona, 20,000 fentanyl pills indicative of wholesale drugs, all things that respondent raised during their argument are absent from the four corners of this affidavit, and that highlights the weaknesses here. All of those things are essential to their argument, but not present in this affidavit. The anticipatory search warrant also, the record is clear how this plays out, and I think imagining what Mr. Dixon went through in this encounter is really important to determining the nexus in this case. So police have this package that they suspect has contraband and conclude per Affiant Spee's affidavit that drugs could be stored in a Xerxes Avenue home. The parcel is delivered by police to that home in February in Minnesota. Mr. Dixon goes to his stoop, picks up the package, walks through the threshold, and a SWAT team immediately descends on the home and proceeds with an entire top-to-bottom search. A reasonable inference, in my view, is that a person will pick up a package that's on their stoop and look at the who's it addressed to or what's inside later. None of that happened here. So there isn't even a nexus that the people inside of this home knew what the package contained. The SWAT team intervened well before there was even any evidence that anyone in the home knew it was there. And as a practical consideration, Mr. Dixon was never charged with or suspected of possessing or dealing with the contents of this box.
But here we have a box, the name on the package.
The name was Alexis Dixon.
Right.
And multiple other members of the Dixon family lived in this home. That, a reasonable inference in my view, is that seeing a misspelled last name because Mr. Dixon spells his name D-I-X-O-N and the package said D-I-C-K-S-O-N would prompt a reasonable person to pick up the package and look closer at, well, who is this package actually addressed to? Is it a neighbor? Is it someone else that I live with? And there we will never know because the record shows that the SWAT team comes in immediately when the box is just picked up. And it's picked up, why? Because police delivered it to this home. And what followed wasn't just seizing the package and searching the package's interior. What followed was a full top-to-bottom search of this person's private home. And the reason for the warrant requirement is rooted in the intense privacy interests of a home, and that standard is the same for a former executive who has documents the police want to seize or a house painter like Mr. Dixon who enjoys the privacy of his home. And for that reason, this court should reverse. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you both for your helpful arguments and briefing. We really appreciate it. We will take the matter under advisement and issue our decision within the statutory 90-day period.
Thank you.